All right, we'll open up the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and we will begin with a public hearing on House Bill 2144. Secretary Bradbury and Elizabeth Harchenko, please.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a real, I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to talk about House Bill 2144. This bill was introduced at my request, and it was introduced as an initial proposal to improve the means whereby the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, and the directors of the Departments of Revenue and Administrative Services develop and adopt the fiscal statements for state measures. Measures that appear both on state ballots and the statements appear in the state voters' pamphlet as well. And we've been meeting since the initial bill was drafted. We knew we wanted to try to propose some change, but we weren't quite sure what it was. So we've been meeting since the initial bill was drafted and have for you today a jointly agreed to set of amendments to House Bill 2144 for you to consider. And obviously it's important for voters to be informed of the potential cost of a measure, and we believe that the current statute is too limited in what the officials can say in a fiscal impact statement. Thus, we are asking the legislature to provide us with some additional tools and flexibility in order to more clearly convey to voters the possible effect of a measure. Now, the amendments that I... Does everyone have copies of the amendments? Yeah. The amendments to the bill do five things. First thing, the current statute requires the committee to estimate the fiscal impact of passage of a measure. Occasionally, the impact of passage does not provide the voter with a clear picture of the measure. Now, that sounds kind of like a circular statement, but let me just give you an example that makes it clear. In 1990, voters faced Measure 90, which sought to reinstate a PUC ruling on the value of the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant. Approval of the measure simply preserved the status quo, meaning that there was no fiscal impact because that was the status quo. Defeat of the measure would have had a huge financial impact on Columbia County's tax base, but the Fiscal Impact Committee had no mechanism to tell voters that that, in fact, was the case. Secondly, the committee is currently required to settle on a single estimate of the impact on the state and a single estimate of the impact on local governments. The committee believes that having the option of presenting a range of costs may give the voters better information than just a specific, here's the impact statement. Third, the committee is now allowed to estimate the direct impact of adoption of a measure, and in many cases, the direct impact does not reflect the true cost of implementation. These amendments would allow the committee, if it deemed that the public would benefit from additional information, to include an estimate of, quote, the most likely financial impact of the adoption or defeat of a measure. Consider a measure to expand borrowing authority, which may even have a statute that goes into effect upon passage of that measure. The direct impact of expanding the bonding authority is zero. That's the effect of expanding the bonding authority. But the likely financial impact of passage includes the sale of bonds. This allows, if we made this change, it'll allow the committee to provide that information to voters. Fourth, because the fiscal impact statements are printed on the ballot, the committee feels constrained to provide full information to voters about the assumptions that go into the estimates that are made. We feel like it's not really appropriate to put all these assumptions on, have them all printed on the ballot. That just adds way too much cost to the cost of getting ballots out to people. The amendments would allow the committee to provide additional information in the voters' pamphlet. Not on the ballot, but explain the assumptions that were made in this fiscal impact statement in the voters' pamphlet. Now, this would include other legislation that will take effect or be repealed if the legislative referral on the ballot is adopted, or if that referral fails to pass. This would be where there may be alternate means of implementation, and there's no clear best choice that can be costed. The alternates can be discussed in terms of, there are several different options here that could be possible. Where federal or state pass-through dollars to local governments are involved, the cost and revenue relationships can be better explained, and other information could be provided the committee believes will benefit the public. And then finally, the Fifth Amendment basically relates to local governments. While many measures affect local governments have no role in current law to develop and adopt the fiscal impact statement. It's basically the treasurer, the secretary of state, the director of the Department of Revenue, and the director of the Department of Administrative Services. There is no representative of local government on the fiscal impact committee. So our proposal in the amendments would add a fifth member representing local governments to the fiscal impact committee. Now, the first version of the bill provided for designees to represent members of the committee. This was discussed because of the difficulty in getting a quorum of three people when you have a committee of four. And the addition of a fifth member alleviates this concern, so we really no longer need the designee portion of the original bill, and the amendments reflect that kind of a change. So with that, I would certainly be happy to take questions. But really, we're interested in trying to do the best job we can of informing the voters about the potential fiscal impacts of a measure. And we've been very, I think it would be correct to say, we've been very frustrated by the current statute, because we know there have been a number of times where we have not been able to communicate anything resembling a fiscal impact because of the way the statute is currently written and the constraints we feel based on the way it's currently written. So,
okay. Any questions for the Secretary? Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for being here and for that. My own interest in local government certainly gives me pause to think that they might have an opportunity to have some input. I think that's very good. Yeah. I want to try to get kind of an idea, because there was one ballot measure, and I want to say 88, but I probably have the wrong number, where the voters voted that everyone who went to prison had to have a job.
Right.
And what wasn't seen in that vote was that every group had to have a supervisor, and that it expanded it. Would those kinds of physical impact statements show on a ballot measure such as that one? For instance, would it reflect the Department of Corrections' added expense?
My sense is that I wasn't doing fiscal impacts when that measure came before us, but I can just relate to my sense is that the goal of these amendments is to try to be able to talk about the logical the logical cost of implementation for the measure, and that would be having a supervisor for a work crew would be a logical cost of implementing this measure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, director of your Department of Revenue, to respond to Representative Verger's question, I think that is exactly what we're trying to accomplish with these changes, is to allow the committee to go to the next level out of what are going to be the practical costs of carrying out the policy that's presented in the ballot measure. We've struggled because the language of the statute talks about direct impact of enactment, doesn't give us the flexibility to do a reasonable estimate of how the legislature might choose to implement and what kinds of sort of next level or rollout costs might be incurred, and that is something that I think frustration is exactly the right word the secretary used, that members of the committee have felt over the 5 years that I've served in this role, that we're constrained by the language right now and being unable to inform the voters of the true potential costs of a choice that they're being asked to make at the ballot.
All right. Nick?
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay. I think just if you can expand a little bit just on, you know, if there's a range, for instance, if you as a group are making a choice of range of the range. I mean, how? I guess I'm envisioning those situations where you might have an initiative come on something that necessarily you don't agree with politically. And, you know, you're going to do what you can to, you know, not you personally, but, you know, people may end up saying, we don't want this to get passed, so we're going to put it in the worst light possible. How do you deal with that kind of situation? And how do we deal with trying to make sure there's still some kind of neutrality in the work that's coming out?
It's Mr. Chair, it's clear today that what the law requires us to do is specifically create one number that is the estimate of the fiscal impact of the cost of implementing this measure. And there are clearly there are a number of different possible costs in any given measure. I mean, depending on how you implement it. And our goal is to try to communicate to people that there could be, in a lot of instances, there could be a range of costs that could range from this to this, depending on the decisions the legislature makes in implementing the law. But to just have to say this measure is going to cost this much and we can't really talk about, we can only talk about what specifically is required in the measure, even if everybody, all of us know that the legislature is going to implement a measure and they're going to have to do something to implement it, but the way the law is currently written, we can only talk about the direct cost of this measure today and make no very, I mean, not even partisan, not even biased one way or the other, just make no, we can't even make assumptions about that this will have to be, there'll have to be some decisions made about how to implement this. I mean, we just can't speak to it.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could add just a little bit. The amendments that we're suggesting would require the committee to include that the statements have to be impartial, simple, and understandable for the voters. If you ever had an opportunity to sit in on one of our meetings as we've struggled with some of the ballot measures, and I'll just use an example because it's a very live one, I think, in our minds. It was a genetically engineered foods measure from the last election. We had an effort on the part of the Department of Agriculture to determine what they thought an appropriate level of activity under that policy would require for regulation and what that would cost. And we recognized that because the measure itself merely adopted a policy and then said the legislature shall implement the legislation, that there was a whole range of choices the legislature could make on implementation, not just asking a state agency to engage in a fairly standard regulatory effort. And so we discussed back and forth quite energetically within the group where we could come in terms of the language that we had. And what we ended up with was no fiscal impact due to the enactment of the measure, because the measure itself required the legislature to figure out how to carry it out.
Uh-huh.
So there was no information available to the public about even the range of, it could be as little as this, it could be as much as that, depending upon what the legislature decides. I think that the fact that the direction that the language would have us go still is objective and impartial, and that it gives the group the opportunity to describe the assumptions that the group is making about the estimate that it is presenting to the public, mitigates against a partial or biased or an effort on the part of the group to influence the outcome of the vote. That we understand that the role that we have is to try to give the voters some information that has some quality to it and reliability to it, that then the voters can make a judgment about do we want to spend what looks like about this much or something within this range to accomplish this objective. And in over the time, as I said, as I've served in this process now for about 5 years with two different secretaries of state, two different treasurers, and two different Department of Administrative Services directors, and we've always tried to focus on what is the most objective, reliable information we can offer to the voters so that they can make an informed choice. We recognize, just like the explanatory committees understand, that it's not our job to persuade the voters. It's our job to give them objective information. The rest of the voters' pamphlet is for people to persuade, and the public debate is for people to persuade. But our understanding is that it's to try to provide some data that the public can then decide whether they want to make those kinds of expenditures. So the range will vary. One other example that I remember vividly is two sessions back, or two election cycles back, there was a measure that would have precluded clear-cutting of forest lands. And we had a huge range of information coming in during the hearing process about the impact on state government of not being able to cut forests, on firefighting, just a whole range of information coming in from the public and from state agencies. And we were trying to sift through all of that and figure out what's the most likely impact that this measure is going to have on the state financially. And I think having a little more flexibility in how we described the range of possible fiscal impacts would probably have been more informative for the voters. So it does all come down to who's sitting in the chairs. You've got two bureaucrats, you've got two elected officials. The four are under this proposal will identify a person from local government to sit as the fifth. But I think that everybody understands that the role of this piece of the process is to provide information, not to persuade.
Thank you. Anything further? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair, for the record, I was asked to let you know the treasurer would have been here because this is something very important to him as well. But he's testifying on the state's bond rating in the Revenue Committee. And we did run the concepts for the amendments by every member of the group, and everyone is in support of them.
Okay, thank you. And there's nobody further listed to testify on this bill, so we will close the hearing on House Bill 2144. And colleagues, we're going to actually kind of go in reverse order on this agenda, first looking at 2142 and then 2141. So with that, we will open up the hearing on House Bill 2142. John Lindback and counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Lindback, Director of the Elections Division in the Secretary of State's office. I'm with me Lynn Rosick, who advises the division from the Department of Justice. Just to give you a little advanced explanation of this bill, this bill is the product of a group effort. I asked the staff at the Elections Division several months ago, let's put together our, we usually have an omnibus, some sort of omnibus election bill that tries to clear up a lot of small problems that have cropped up in the election law, and asked staff to recommend changes that they thought we should make. And then we had a radical idea, which was, gee, are there any old laws that we could get rid of? So, and included in this bill is something that you probably never thought you'd see, which is an agency coming in asking you to delete some laws rather than just all pass new stuff. So we do have a few items like that at the end. There's a summary submitted by the division, and what I'd like to do is walk you through that summary, because this is a rather lengthy bill that covers a broad range of subjects, and I think that we can walk through it here and provide you a little bit of insight about what section is all about, because if you simply try to read the bill itself, it's pretty difficult to read. Section 1 basically codifies some 1980s era Oregon Supreme Court opinions, which allowed for 60 days from the ballot title certification to appeal and the Secretary of State's rule on procedural constitutional compliance review. And I think Lynn can provide you a little background on this, since this is a suggestion from the Department of Justice and sort of reflects what's been going on in some case law regarding initiatives.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lynn Rosick from the Department of Justice. Most of you are familiar with the fact that for the last several decades, the Oregon Supreme Court has ruled that the Secretary of State, in his role as the Chief Elections Officer, has the obligation to determine whether proposed initiative measures comply with what we call the procedural constitutional requirements of initiatives under the Oregon Constitution. There were a number of cases that determined that back in the 80s. The legislature has, to this day, never adopted anything specifically in the statutes that talks about this duty of the secretaries. But back in 1986, after the cases came down, with the advice of the Department of Justice, the Secretary of State then adopted an administrative rule to set up a process for this. And he continues to do that to this day during the period of time that ballot titles are drafted. He makes a decision as to whether an initiative petition complies with the constitutional requirements. Is it a single subject? Does it contain the full text? And now, in the modern era, is it a single amendment if it's a constitutional amendment? And I'm sure you're well aware that there have been a number of cases in the last few years that have invalidated initiative measures, particularly on the basis of separate amendment, that have made this a particularly important duty. The only purpose of this bill, I'm aware that there's other bills that have been presented that deal with this issue more directly, but this bill does is codify the period of time in which someone needs to challenge pre-election this particular decision that the Secretary makes. We have an administrative rule, and there are also these Supreme Court cases out there. It appeared that it would be beneficial to everyone in the state if it was clear in the statute how much time and from what event challenges to this decision should be made. And so all it does is say that you have to file a challenge within 60 days of the day that the Secretary makes the decision. which is consistent with what the rule says now.
Okay, Lynn, can you explain, I guess, what the process is? I mean, you're seeing how it goes to the circuit court first, and then the circuit, if they're not headed with that, they can appeal to the appeals court. What kind of time frame are we looking at when there's these kind of appeals?
All right, Mr. Chair, it's a time-consuming process, and we're not proposing to actually change that process at all. I know there's other bills that address that more directly. At this time, the initiative will come in sometime during the two-year period of each cycle. The Secretary makes the decision at the end of the ballot title drafting process, which is about 2 months out from when it originally was filed. And if his decision is to reject the initiative petition because it does not meet the constitutional requirements, that needs to be challenged within 60 days. If his decision is to accept it, then that same 60 days applies. That is filed in Marion County Circuit Court as a regular trial proceeding, and then it is litigated. And you're right, it goes sort of slowly. It has happened that the Court of Appeals has ruled on these cases before the filing deadline, but it's difficult to have that happen.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a similar question, I think. Just reading this amendment, and it's sub 2 of section 1, isn't it, that we're talking about?
Yes.
Just looking at that, I'm not sure that I know how this procedures get carried out so that we end up with an order served, the last three words of the amendment, so that we can start the 60 days running. How does that work?
Well, the order is not, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the order is not served in the sense of served on a party, because there are no parties to this. But the day the decision is made, it is served on all of the participants in the process of making this decision, the chief petitioners and anyone who has filed comments. And it is also posted online and communicated statewide through the Secretary of State's listserv. So that's what's meant by that. That's the day that triggers it. And anyone who wants to can get onto the listserv and be notified instantly when these decisions are made.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Ms. Rothrock. Mm-hmm. Is the 60 days the whole time frame within which an appeal must be filed and completed, or simply the time frame in which an appeal may be filed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's just when the appeal must be filed. It doesn't need to be completed. They could file it on the 60th day, and that would start the litigation process.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to go on to sections 2 and 3, which are very similar. They just affect different offices. We have a little oddity in state law that requires both DAs and the Attorney General, when they file their oath of office, for the oath to be filed on the back of their certificate of election. That's not true for anyone else in state government. We can't figure out why this was required of them. But it frankly causes one of my employees to pull her hair out trying to get certificates with seals on them through a copier on both sides of the piece of paper. And it also treats them differently from everybody else. So the effect of this would be their oath of office would be filed just simply on a separate piece of paper with archives where it is always filed. And we'd just like to get rid of that little oddity in state law. Section 4. We have a problem with some conflicting statutes in regards to the election of sheriff, county clerk, county assessor, treasurer, and surveyor. Our election statutes say that you're not required to be elected at the general election if you receive more than 50% of the votes cast for any of those offices. But this other statute, 204.005, says that they're elected at the general election, and there's conflicting statutes. So we'd like to clear up that problem with conflicting statutes so that they all follow current practice. Section 5, ORS 236325. This has to do with another case of conflicting statutes, and we have an illogical deadline as far as handling vacancies in an office close to filing election, close to the filing period for an election. Under ORS 249200 and 249205, vacancies after the 21st day are handled with some special filing deadlines. This statute, which is 236325, currently is odd because it says when the effective date of the resignation is less than 21 days before the deadline for filing a nominating petition, etc., that it would go on the next general election. Or to fill the office at the general election next following the effective date of the resignation, that we would have to deal with electing that person at the very next election, and that's first of all very difficult to deal with. It's that close to an election. We'd like to correct this so that this deadline is consistent and is more logical. Section 6. This is correcting an error made in the 2001 session. We had a bill that passed that made the Office of County Judge, we have like five or six of those in rural Oregon, and they wanted to make them nonpartisan offices, but they also by mistake made them a state office rather than continuing them as a county office, and this would correct that error made by the 2001 session and clarify that they are not state offices. Section 7 and Section 8 relate back to the legislation that was passed in the last session. As you all recall, the actual filing deadlines were changed in legislation relating to term limits to allow a lawsuit for term limits and for people to file early. These two sections would restore the old filing dates to what they were before that legislation because the filing dates were moved very far out in order to accommodate that situation. Section 9 is another conformity section. It reduces the number of signatures on a nominating petition that major political party candidates for non-statewide races must collect from 1,000 to 500 when the major political party did not nominate presidential electors in the last presidential election. This conforms the signature requirement to that of other non-statewide candidates, so that there was nothing that we could see where they it justifies that they should be different. Section 10.
Madam Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Does this ever come up? Does this ever happen in 9 that a major party doesn't nominate presidential, whatever that is, we're dealing with?
I've never heard of it coming up.
Okay.
But, you know. All right. Election law tries to cover the whole panoply of possibilities.
Every possibility. Thank you. Let's go on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Section 10. This is another conformity question. It requires minor party and non-affiliated candidates for partisan offices to provide information on their candidacy form that the candidate will qualify if elected and a statement of the candidate's occupation, educational and occupational background, and prior governmental experience. The candidates must also sign the form certifying the truth of the information. Currently, the requirements for these minor party and non-affiliated candidates are different from the requirements for other candidates, and we don't see any logical reason for that, and we would like to make them all the same, and that is the reason for Section 10. Section 11, we now have some confusion caused by having different deadlines for receiving a draft for the date when the Attorney General certifies the draft ballot title for an initiative petition. It's, if there are no written comments, then they have to do it by the 15th business day after the Secretary of State receives the draft ballot title. And we want to change that to the 20th business day so that we don't have two different deadlines for when there are no comments submitted or for when there are comments submitted. It's confusing to people, and it's confusing to us and confusing to the agencies. Sections 12 and 13, this and 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 all are similar sections that affect different levels of government, but they will clarify that counties, cities, and district filing officers review proposed initiatives for all the procedural constitution requirements, and that the explanation, I mean, this is the same for all these different levels of government. Section 12 and 13 address counties and cities. Section 14 and 15 addresses city measures. Sections, am I getting confused here, 16 and 17 to district election officials. Okay, section 18. This places in statute a current practice handled by directive to the county elections officials. It provides that candidates for nonpartisan positions who are not nominated by a political party have the word independent printed next to their name on the ballot. These are candidates who are nominated by an assembly of electors or individual electors.
John?
Yes.
Just to bring up scene above that addition that you made in subsection D, is subsection C talking about the word incumbent for judges. Did you have any discussion about having judges being classified separately as any other elected official of having that designation?
We have not.
Do you have any comment on that?
Well, we have had discussions internally about how they are treated differently, but it seems to be a longstanding practice in Oregon, and not one that we were willing, at least at this point, to come forward and suggest changing.
Okay,
section 19.
Sure, that's Mona Sanderson.
What if they don't want to be considered independent? Then are they considered partisan? If it's a Green Party vote.
I think under the law, Representative Anderson, and Lincoln, correct me if I'm wrong, under our law, if they're not nominated by a political party, they are considered to be independent.
And just to follow up, right now, they just have no designation after their name, is that correct?
No, we're doing it now by rule.
Okay.
This would place in law what we now do by rule.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is that by putting the word independent next to somebody's name, you basically create a political party without them having to go through the normal process of becoming a political party. And because independents are now 20% of the electorate, I would hate to see you do that. And apparently you already are doing it. Can you address that?
Well, I guess I would say that I'm not sure that people consider the word independent to mean that you are affiliated with a political party. Your comment, Representative Close, was that we're somehow creating another political party, but the meaning of the word is that you're not affiliated with a political party. And I'm not sure I can go much beyond that in comment.
I guess there's a big difference between saying you're nonpartisan, which means no political party. You hear a lot of people, you don't hear people say, I'm nonpartisan, mm-hmm. but you do hear them say, I'm an independent. So to me, there's a big difference between those two words. Mm. People do identify that with that group of people.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that same point, John, I tend to agree with Representative Close. I think when you register, it's the number of political parties are listed, and then nonpartisan is also there. I don't think it's independent. It's
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on that, Representative Backlund, I think that what the form says is not affiliated with any party. And that's kind of the technical term that the Elections Division generally uses, is not affiliated. The reason that something is listed at, and the word proposed is independent, is these are the partisan races only. So, for instance, legislative race or governor or president, everyone else who's qualified for the ballot has come through a party process, either a major political party or a minor political party. They'll have their party listed after them. And so in order for these people to, so people have some idea where they came from, how they got there, the idea is they've come through the process where they're not affiliated with a party, they're independent. They've reached it without coming through any political party. And that's traditionally what that word's been used to convey, is that they didn't, they weren't nominated by any party.
Follow-up?
Sure, follow-up.
But do you think independent is a better term than not affiliated? Not affiliated is much more specific than independent, because historically there have been periods of time when we actually had independent parties. Or people would call themselves, well, it was an organized political party. Not affiliated is, I think, a much more specific term and conveys exactly that meaning.
Representative Backlund, if I might respond.
Oh, please. If it's all right with the chair.
I don't think we have any real strong emotional attachment to the word independent. If the wisdom of the committee is that not affiliated would be a better word, that's why we bring these bills forward. And I have no objection to not affiliated. If the sense of the committee is that they like that word better. It's always difficult to sort of project how the voters react to certain words. I don't know. I mean, the voters are used to the word independent in these kinds of situations. I don't think it's going to be a real earth-shattering change if we change it to non-affiliated. I don't know that I have any real strong evidence anywhere that the word independent is a problem for them.
Representative Barnhart?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Backlund asked my question.
Okay. Okay. Proceed.
Okay. Section 19 actually corrects something that's wrong in statute. It would revise the warning language on the ballot or ballot label about the use of undue influence in voting. Currently, the statute specifies that the violation, specifies the violation is a subject to a fine in accordance with ORS 260655, and that's a civil penalty. And currently, the statutory language indicates that this violation is a crime, and we want to correct this problem. Section 20 came as the request of the county clerks. This would delete the requirement for county clerks to create a register of nominations for county offices to the general election. They feel that the register is unnecessary because it is redundant to what is on their certified ballot. They don't see any reason, a logical reason, why they should be doing this twice.
And to, I guess, follow up on that, I mean, how did it get there in the first place, do you know?
Well, that's a good question. It's rather old, as I understand it, and none of us have understood that either. You know, why people have been looking at each other in meetings going, we don't understand why we're being required to do this. So, Section 21, we have a lack of clarity in the current statute as to who receives the final abstract and the deadline for the Secretary of State to certify results in certain recall elections. So this would clarify that the county clerk delivers the abstract of the votes for recall elections to the elections official authorized to order the recall. If the Secretary of State is the elections official, it provides a deadline of the 30th day after the election to declare the results, which is consistent with with our deadlines and other elections. Section 22. Section 37 of this bill repeals the statute, and so in Section 22 we're simply deleting the reference to a statute that later on in the bill is repealed. Section 23 is the same situation. Section 37 repeals a statute from the list of criminal penalties, and this section just deletes a reference to that statute. Section 24 this is a change to 260995. It changes where civil penalties imposed for violations are paid. Currently, civil penalties for violations of ORS 260432, which are prohibitions on political campaigning by public employees, are paid to the political subdivisions of the employee in violation. And so if somebody at School District X violated the law and we imposed a penalty, the penalty would be the money that we collect would go back to that school district. This amendment would cause the civil penalties to be paid into the state treasury and credited to the general fund. And this would create consistency with all the other civil penalties for elections violations that are paid and credited to the general fund. And we have failed to see the justification for treating these election violations differently. This would not be a big loss of revenue for these jurisdictions. Since 1989, we have assessed exactly 48 penalties total under this law. Section 25, this just clears up some outmoded language. We have a reference in 246310 to the, quote, division of a poll book. Since we're all vote by mail now, we don't have poll books anymore in the statute. It's unnecessary. Section 26 is simply adding 250038 under as a reference under the statute as a statute applying to all initiatives and referenda. It was accidentally left out of 250041. Section 27 is a language cleanup in ORS 251255. We take out the reference to a statewide measure and change it to state measure, which is a change we've been trying to make wherever we find it. Section 28 is another simple cleanup in 254462. We have a list of statutes that are applicable to vote by mail elections, and 254480 and 254482 are inadvertently left out. We'd like to put them back in. Section 29. Under ORS 254482, it deletes the statement that this section applies only to elections conducted by mail. The reference proposed in Section 28 makes this statement unnecessary. In Section 30, ORS 254515, this deletes some incorrect language. Currently, out-of-state voters, let's say that you are out-of-state and you are traveling through Oregon on Election Day when we're electing the president. You could vote in Oregon. You could ask to vote in Oregon, and you could vote for president only because that would be the only race that you could vote for here that for which you would qualify. This deletes some incorrect language in 254515 that states that these voters could vote for federal offices. They could not vote for all federal offices on the ballot. They would not be qualified to vote for one of our congressional seats or one of our Senate seats, but they could vote for president. So we're just making a correction here in law.
Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A couple of questions I think I can make sense out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Is this required by some constitutional or federal law that you know about?
That we're required to let them vote here?
Yes.
No, we don't think so. We think this is an Oregon thing.
And a follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up, sure.
Are those ballots then sent off to the state where they're actually resident, or do we count them in our totals?
Well, we would check to make sure they didn't vote in their other location, and then they would count in our total.
for our electoral votes.
Mm-hmm. We're very kind in Oregon.
Yeah. Just if I may make a comment, Mr. Chair, it seems to me that in a very unusual, strange sort of election, it might be possible for people to come up from California or down from Washington simply to grab Oregon's electoral votes. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that would take a rather grand conspiracy, but...
not a conspiracy at all, I don't think. I mean, it's happened lately that that people have traded votes in different states, and as I understand it, that's legal practice. It's not unlawful to do that. It just seems strange to me that it would be in a statute, that's all.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Representative Flores.
Thank you. John, do you have any tracking that shows how often we do allow presidential-only votes here in Oregon?
No, I don't. I don't have for you today. I could ask the county since they would have this information, and I don't. I don't think it's very common, particularly for presidential elections. You know, that's the big election where everybody really wants to vote in their home, at their home. But we could check and see if.
Curious to see if it's one or a thousand.
To see if it's a big thing. I don't think it is.
It makes sense, though, to check it, only that if we can get rid of this, you know, if it's not being used, then mm-hmm. it might be a better option. Okay. Proceed.
Section 32. Oh, wait, I skipped one. I'm sorry. Section 31. This clarifies that reports of contributions received during a legislative session shall be filed with the Secretary of State. Currently, all these reports are filed with us, but the statute does not specify where the reports are to be filed, so we're just doing some cleanup. Yes. Section 32.
Hold it.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, John. I do have a question on the subparagraph 1 there, and it's not specifically referenced here in what you're dealing with, but... requiring that the period begins January 1 immediately preceding a regular biennial session of the Legislative Assembly, and only because I've bumped into that this time, I wasn't really an officially elected or officially sworn in and therefore acting legislator until January 13th and yet required to report January 1. Seems a little bit conflicting to me. Why do we do that?
Well, this law is fairly new. Mm-hmm. I'll let Lynn take it because she was here when it was adopted.
Chair Doral, Representative Flores, the language in 260.076 is pretty much pulled right out of the old statute that banned contributions during the legislative session. It's the exact same period that applies to the exact same officials. You'll recall, for those of you who were here, in 2001, the attorney, and we'll talk about that in the other bill, 2141, but the statute banning contributions during the legislative session was the subject of an attorney general opinion that declared that that was unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 8. And actually, that statute's still on the books, and we're proposing it for repeal in House Bill 2141. But this was the replacement statute, and so the desire was to simply transfer the ban on contributions virtually exactly into a reporting requirement, which is what this statute does, is require the reporting within 2 business days. And so it matches up with the last supplement to the post that is required that goes through December 31st of the election year, and then the next day this new statute kicks in. But you'll see that it applies to candidates and legislative officials. So technically, I guess, until January 13th, you were under it as a candidate, and then on January 13th as a legislative official. So it's just a clean date. They don't. It doesn't go from the first day of the legislative session. It goes from January 1.
Follow up?
Sure, follow up.
On the other side of that discussion, however, when we use the term regular biennial session of the Legislative Assembly, the Legislative Assembly didn't really begin on January 1 either.
Right.
I'm just curious.
Yes. Chair Doyle, Representative Flores, that's right. It says during the period beginning January 1, immediately preceding a regular biennial session. So it's always that odd year January 1 is when it starts. So it's always is about a week to 10 days or whatever before the session actually starts.
Thank you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Chair Doyle. I just would say I'd have some concern about that because it is not the legislative session, and I don't know why you would have statutes that apply to the legislative session when you're not in it.
Right.
I think that's a problem. Either you're in it or you're not.
Right. And I think we might hold the discussion for the, as we start getting into the CNEs on the next bill and then what we do Thursday. But, you know, to me, it's probably the best way to rectify that is as we decide when these post supplements take, you know, the deadlines are those. I mean, if it's a December 31 as an example, and I think the issue is more that you're doing this immediate reporting and it's considered as a contribution during the session when in fact you can get a contribution on the 31st and that's not considered an in-session contribution. So maybe we're doing something on that rule or on that statute to, you know, have it. So I think the idea is that we don't want to not disclose, but we want to make sure that we're being fair to everybody as they're making their contributions as well. So go ahead and proceed.
Well, I didn't expect that one to
seem like
sorry.
A simple amendment.
That's all right.
Because you don't have to run.
that's why we do this.
Chair Doyle, just a comment and thank you very much. It was just, I was very frustrated about that. So, personally.
No, it's good for us to know that, actually. So thank you. Section 32, this is another one of those cases where we're just changing the language where it says statewide measure to state measure. Section 33 I'm going to let Lynn handle because she wanted to propose a reorganization of the statute. And so I'm going to let you handle that one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there were several statutes that are listed in the description here that have to do with buying and selling ballots and then ballot materials. And as the state has evolved into vote by mail to the point now where we're doing every election vote by mail, it's become more important, I think, to just kind of look at these statutes that have to do with ballot materials and make sure that there isn't, you know, that there are strong penalties against people misusing these, selling them, buying them, whatever. And there were since they were in several statutes, we're really just trying to consolidate them into one statute. And we want to make it clear to you that some of the statutes that we're consolidating into 260.715 will be the new sub 8. Comes from a statute that was not a criminal penalty. So we're actually moving some things that weren't criminal penalty into a criminal penalty, but we felt that the offense was similar enough that it was appropriate that the criminal penalty applied to all of these things. So you'll see the language on page 17 of the bill, lines 16 through 21, where it talks about sell, offer to sell, purchase or offer to purchase for money or other valuable consideration, any official ballot, replacement ballot, ballot return identification envelope, or secrecy envelope. We simply want people to treat these as their own personal property to vote, and they're not commodities, and that's the concept here.
Questions?
Yeah,
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you saying that the selling of ballots and ballot materials is already in statute, or it's not clear? And also, do we have any proof that this has happened?
I'm sorry, do we have any proof of
the selling of ballots or the purchasing of ballots? Do we know that that's going on? Have we had any evidence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I think that there have from time to time been complaints where possibly that people have perhaps in a what they thought was a lighthearted way have said my ballot's for sale or whatever, but I don't think we've actually ever prosecuted a case like that. None of what's listed in the new subsection 8 of 260.715, we're not creating new offenses. We're just consolidating several different statutes that had all of these offenses to try to put them all in one logical place. But
I'm pointing out that they're criminal offenses because we do consider them to be serious issues, and we don't want this to be something that people felt as though there was some minor civil penalty so that there was nothing really wrong with doing this.
Could I just clarify, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
So you're saying that the selling or purchasing of ballots, that is prohibited already?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Question?
Yes, Representative Sanderson.
This just raises another issue that isn't going to maybe relevant here. I just want some clarification when you're talking about the return identification envelope. I'm not sure is that the one that's inside the envelope that you get.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miles Anderson, that
yes,
that,
no,
that
I know what it is.
Yes, that's the one you sign on the outside.
But there is, I have a post office box, and there are a lot of ballots. When the ballots come, people just throw them away, and there's a lot of ballots left on the counter, et cetera. Post office doesn't do anything with them; they just toss them in. Correct? If they're already out of the post office box and they're on the counter.
Chair Doyle, Representative Miles Anderson, I don't know what they do with them. I've never actually heard of that there were piles of ballots around.
I thought there was maybe a dozen. Not a lot. But
I assume if they're discarded that the post office would not leave them on the counter but would take them away and recycle them or something. And then if somebody changed their mind later and decided they did want to vote, they can obtain a replacement ballot if they somehow lost their ballot.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking on page 17 of the bill in section 32. And I just had a question. You're deleting, I see now where you have the in statute the selling of the ballot. Mm-hmm. However, it talks about an absentee ballot, which is now deleted in the new language. Are there no longer technically absentee ballots? And is there a reason that you've deleted that language?
Sub 9.
Mm-hmm. Sub 9.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Close. Well, an absentee ballot is a variation of a ballot that's mailed. It's considered absentee if it goes out of state or out of the country, but it's the same ballot that's mailed within the state to regular vote-by-mail voters. So it used to say absentee ballot or any ballot mailed to an elector, which is essentially covers the gamut. So it's not really necessary to designate that. It's just we're just talking about any official ballot, replacement ballot, that covers everything.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
We're down to section 33.
That was section 33.
All right. Okay, then we go on to section 34. And this is another section that will specify in statute what is currently in practice, and it would require filing officers to examine for sufficiency the September supplemental reports. It deletes the requirement for filing officers to examine for sufficiency the supplement to the second pre-election report and the supplement to the post, because that information is included in other reports that are currently examined. Section 35. And Section 36, are situations where we had statutes that were adopted in 2001 but not assigned a chapter location, and these would specify those chapter locations. Section 37 is the section where we repeal some statutes, and I'll address the first one, and I'll let Lynn address the others. So the first one is the statute that limits the right of nonpartisan or independent and minor party candidates from claiming membership in a major political party in any fashion during their campaigns. These candidates under this statute are only allowed to use the terms independent or nonpartisan. So in other words, if you were going to run for superintendent of public instruction, I think is a case of this. As a candidate, you are not allowed to say, while you're out there on the campaign trail or in your material, what party you belong to. But others can. Somebody could run an independent expenditure, and people have. And that is perfectly legal for others to talk about what party you belong to. We propose repealing this so that you can tell people what party you belong to, even though you're running for a nonpartisan office. because this is a limitation on the candidate's right to provide truthful information and prevents free speech issues. It presents, excuse me, some free speech issues that hinder our enforcement of this statute. We've already run up against this and do not believe we would win if we tried to press it. So these candidates will still be identified on the ballot as nonpartisan or independent candidates, but it would allow them, while they're out there on the campaign trail, to say, yes, I am a Democrat, or I am a Republican, or whatever.
Not affiliated.
Or not affiliated, or independent, whatever you want to use.
John,
yes?
Can you, I guess, just take it the other look at the other side? I mean, why then would we even have nonpartisan positions? I mean, what is that? What's the impact?
Well, I think the nonpartisan positions, where it has the real impact, as you say, is on the ballot. Your name is not labeled with a party when it's on the ballot, and it would not be labeled with a party in the voter's pamphlet, for example. And so, I mean, that's where the real impact is. And what you say out there on the campaign trail, I think what we're trying to tell you here today is that if we got a complaint under this law and tried to go after someone for this, we wouldn't win. It's a free speech issue.
Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to delve into this further. Looks like the statute now says you cannot say you're in a major political party if you're not. And then you say you need to repeal it so people can give truthful information, but they're not giving truthful information if they say they're in a party that they're not, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, the second sentence says an unaffiliated candidate, a candidate of a minor political party, or a candidate for nonpartisan office shall not claim to be a member of any major political party in the candidate's candidacy. So even a party that you have been a lifelong member of and perhaps elected to public office many times in, you may not claim your party affiliation. So the first sentence talks about you shall not claim to be a member of a major political party of which the candidate is not a member. But it's the second sentence that says that an unaffiliated candidate, a candidate for a minor political party, or a candidate for nonpartisan office shall not claim. So that's where the truthful information comes in.
So the nonpartisan office is the problem, where you have major political parties running for a nonpartisan office. Is that correct?
Well, that's where we've been seeing the problem so far, but the repeal would also mean that an unaffiliated candidate, for instance, somebody who was nominated by an assembly of electors to a partisan office, could say, well, I'm not the nominee of the Republican Party, but I am a lifetime member of the Republican Party. They could say that then, which right now they're just absolutely forbidden for saying that anywhere in their campaign literature.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Chair, follow up.
But couldn't an independent also say that untruthfully and they would not be prosecuted? That's the way it seems to be. And I don't think we want independents saying they're part of a major political party if they're not. It's not free speech. It's lying. So how can then they be prosecuted? Or, I mean, how can they be stopped?
But I don't think this bill would this law would prohibit them. This particular law here would prohibit them from doing that.
From doing what?
From being independent and claiming they're a Republican. That's the scenario you were just...
Right.
Did I understand you correctly?
Right.
You're saying... What would prohibit someone from being an independent and claiming they were either a Republican or Democrat?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this law would prohibit that.
Okay, you're talking about the old statute or the new one you're proposing?
The current statute.
The
one that we're proposing to delete.
It seems to imply that you cannot claim membership in a major party if you're an independent. I understand the nonpartisan problem because the office is nonpartisan. I guess if I was to write this, I would go after the nonpartisan part. But I would not take away the whole statute that says, as an independent, you can claim membership in a political party. You know, you see what I'm saying? I think you've got two different things in what you're writing there, and I think you need to concentrate on the nonpartisan and not allow the independents or the minor party candidates to claim membership in a major political party.
I understand what you're saying. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
or Representative Onsanders?
Yes, follow-up. So we have it, you're referring to offices like a judge, nonpartisan.
Just for the committee's benefit, on page 3 of this bill, up top, subsection 7 shows the nonpartisan offices.
Not applying to them.
These are the nonpartisan offices.
Right. So if you have, say, a county judge, and they are a Democrat or a Republican, that they could have that in the voter's pamphlet? They could put that after their name then? No.
Well, the voter's pamphlet, you know, would not label that as a partisan office.
Right.
We would not do that because it's a nonpartisan office. But in the summary, they could certainly say that they're a Republican or a Democrat if they want to.
And right now they can't.
Right now they cannot.
Representative Barnhart?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was simply going to note that I think Representative Close's concerns are well taken. The first sentence would seem to me of the 249.015 would seem to me to be perfectly appropriate, even with the concerns that you have about speech.
Sure.
The second sentence would need to be reworked in order to apply only to false statements. And the third sentence could go away. But I share her concerns.
Anything further?
So when you, may I ask a question? I'm sorry. So when you say the second section should be reworked, the second sentence, what you're suggesting is the second sentence be reworked to reflect the problem we were talking about with it being unenforceable?
What I'm concerned about is that we get rid of the unenforceability of it, but still prohibit false statements.
Okay.
And I think that's what Representative Close was talking about,
okay,
too.
Okay.
Thank you. Do you want to handle the other one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just very quickly go over, unless you have questions, the last, I think it's 5 statutes that are proposed for repeal. We've given you a short summary of what each statute says, and because they're in a repeal statute, they're not actually set out in the bill. But each of these statutes goes back into the far reaches of time before any of us who have been working in elections can really remember when they came into being. And it appears to us, because we receive no complaints about them, that either they're something that doesn't happen or that they're covered by other statutes. I suggested it under 266.05, purchase of advertising or payment for editorial advocacy, which I guess would be paying someone to obtain an endorsement or an editorial in favor of a candidate, is more appropriately covered under the undue influence statute. The idea is to delete these extremely specific, very narrow statutes and try to get at the issue through a general statute, which is generally the undue influence statute, which means providing something force or threat of force or a thing of value in order to obtain some election benefit. So that our same concept holds true for 266.15, prohibits special privileges by public utilities, political committees, or candidates, which is something that I assume that under rate basis they're not permitted to do anyway. But the next one is buying and selling a convention credential. These statutes, we just aren't perceiving these as to be issues that need to be specific statutes. And then finally, the last one, requiring payment for putting a name in a convention or a caucus ballot. I think these sort of things are probably covered by party rule as well. And finally, the last statute proposed for repeal is 267.18. That goes back to the discussion we just had in Section 33 about trying to combine all of those statutes having to do with buying and selling ballots into one provision. This is the statute that would be repealed, and the coverage of it would go into 267.15. Any questions on that?
Any questions, members? Okay. Good analysis. Thank you. All right. And we'll now call up Annette Newingham, County Clerks.
Chair Doyle and members of the committee, I'm Annette Newingham. I'm a Lane County election official, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I'll be brief, which you'll probably be pleased with, but wanted to tell you that we're in general support of this bill. Primarily, we were here on the Section 20, and you raised a question about it as well, dealing with the taking out the situation where the county clerk has to do a special register of nominations. And I believe I understand why that was happening in the past, and that was because we didn't have computers and we didn't have summary sheets that actually gave a summary of who won the election during a nomination. So they would have to take the abstracts and actually do a register so that somebody would know what the outcomes of those were. I have old records, and they're all handwritten. Everything was handwritten. So I'm pretty sure that it's redundant because computers have really provided summaries that provide that information on that. Also, you raised an issue about the presidential limited ballot, and I thought I would at least share Lane County's information on that, and that it's very rare to get a limited ballot for presidential only. The two circumstances that we've run into is when somebody has lived in another country for many years as a United States citizen, lived in Oregon, but last known address, but didn't have the actual address because it's been so many years, so they're not qualified to vote a full ballot, but they are qualified to vote for president. That's one circumstance, and then it would count in your own in the state of Oregon. The other circumstance is when they move out of our state and they go to another state, but they don't qualify to vote in the new state because they don't they don't meet the requirements of the registration for that new state, but they still qualify to vote for president, and then we provide them a limited ballot, and then because they're not registered in the new state, that's why we would count it in our state. And those are the two circumstances I'm aware of, but it's very rare. We, at the most, I think we get one or two in a presidential election.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you think many people really know that they can do that?
Chair Doyle and Representative Berger, usually presidential elections people care a lot about, and what they may not know it directly, but what they start doing is asking questions. They run into roadblocks and they find out they want to vote for president. They go to the new state, for instance, and they say, no, you don't qualify. Well, what can you do? If they came to us and they came from another state, we'd say, go check with your last county that you were registered at to see what the rules are for your state, to see if you qualify. We try to help them out if they're coming or going. Most election officials are very dedicated to try to help people to comply with state law wherever they happen to be. And that's usually the circumstance, and people care a lot about voting for a president.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
If you have a second home in another state, and or maybe Oregon is your second home, and you would come here, you may think that you'd have to have residency for a full year. You don't think that's possible, that people would think that?
I haven't specifically run into that particular situation. We would certainly try to get to the point of what their circumstance is. If they're coming to us asking questions, they're trying to find out, and we're going to get them the right answer. If they don't ask us, we might not know that they have a problem. But I think that people are generally concerned about voting on the local issues as well as the president, and so they're going to try to get registered to the area that they're actually living. It's kind of a vague answer, and I'm sorry, it's probably not adequate.
Last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I just would say that we do have some areas, however, in Oregon who have many residences that just are not there all the time. I think of Bend, mm-hmm. The Bend, Redmond, Pine area, where there are many, many people that are just there 2 or 3 months of the year or just in the summer. And it's kind of an interesting concept, though of course the election is in November, but they may be there for Thanksgiving, Christmas, primarily, and so forth. So I'm not sure I knew that people could do that. That's the reason I'm kind of surprised.
Okay. Reps, I'm close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now I'm just interested in the process that went on with this particular bill. We're told it was a product of a group effort. We have 36 county clerks. Can you tell me the size of the group that worked on this bill, how many of the county clerks were involved, and how all the county clerks seen the bill and signed off on it?
Well, first of all, this particular bill, it does say that it was introduced for the Association of County Clerks, and somehow that was sort of misleading, because there's portions of this that is the Secretary of State's office. We had portions of it. So we don't have objections to any of the parts of the bill, but the Association of County Clerks is really more specifically involved in only particular sections of this bill. Does that make sense? And yes, the clerks were involved in those sections.
Okay. I call it Mr. Chair or Ms. Chair.
And it was.
Thank you. So the size of the group, do you know what the size of the group was?
Yes. Chair Flores and Representative Close. What we do is we meet, the Association of County Clerks meets twice a year. We meet at the winter conference, and in February we met, and we also met last summer during August. And when we do that, all the clerks are generally represented, the majority, if not all of them. And at that point, we discuss this legislation, all the things that we were going to propose, anything that was introduced early session. And we went over that, and as a group, we vote on it to see that we are unanimous, or that we are the majority is represented. This bill was part of that package.
Last one. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're saying you voted on certain sections. Can you tell me which sections you voted on?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, at the time that we discussed this, it was not a bill. It was concepts. We spoke to the actual concepts of, and the one that we talked about specifically was Section 20, which is one that we asked to have as part of this housekeeping bill. That was the specific issue that we, as the Association of County Clerks, discussed at our conferences. The remaining part of the bill, the Secretary of State's office they have a portion of the conference that they speak to us and talk to us about the things that they are planning to introduce in this bill. And at that point, we did it as a package. We didn't go over, we went over each section, and then we talked about the housekeeping bill in general, and we did it as a majority.
Mr. Chair, I would submit that it is a little misleading to say that this is at the request of the Oregon Association of County Clerks when they only had input or only voted on one section.
It was unusual in this particular circumstance, and it was not intentional the way it came out.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barnhart, did you have something?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. No one further signed up to testify on this bill. No? Okay, so we'll close the public hearing on 2142 and open up a public hearing on 2141. And just told it there in a minute, Mr. Neal. We've looking at the timing of this. My thinking is we're going to probably hold your presentation to Thursday, and maybe with Annette Newingham. What do you think about giving testimony on it now versus
on the 41? Yes, I think fine.
And then we can. Members, this is kind of a two-part process. We have another bill that we're going to be reviewing on Thursday. It's House Bill 2929, which has also been presented as a some suggested modifications to the contributions and expenditure reporting process. And what we'll do is and a majority of 2141 is related to that as well. So we'll it kind of works out probably better that we're going to get the main analysis from Mr. Neal on Thursday, and then we'll also have 2929 reviewed. And just as a further update, we're going to be setting a work group together on this issue to see if we might be able to get some modifications completed on the C&E reporting process through this session. Okay? So, Nate, go ahead.
Back. Chair Doyle and members of the committee, I'd like to start out by pointing out this has the same problem that it says that it's for the Association of County Clerks, and it should have said, and we only have a portion of this bill. We did not. It was not on behalf of the full Association of County Clerks. The two sections that the Association of County Clerks had input to and asked to have was Section 5. And Section 5 it has to do with contributions and expenditures when we have oftentimes someone will have a zero amount and over years they do not discontinue it. And at the current time, we have to keep it on the books indefinitely until they actually file discontinue the statement of organization. And we would like to have that so that there is an administrative rule by the Secretary of State's office that we could go ahead and discontinue it without the individual doing so, because in most cases on a local level, it's just that they've forgotten about it, or perhaps they've even moved out of the area. Other section...
To clarify then,
yes.
Section 5 is stated as the county clerks would like to have it stated, or is there something you want changed?
No, we would like it the way it is fine. Thank you. And the other section is Section 18, and that is also a housekeeping. It's an old portion of the bill. The statutes have required that we prepare a summary regarding the candidates for county office and county measures. And the Association of County Clerks was asking that it would be changed from shall to may. It's redundant to what we already currently do. We already provide a summary, and it's very similar to the situation in the previous bill where computers have provide a lot of information already, and it was probably because at one point in time everything had to be handwritten, and it seems to be redundant, and we would like to have that as an option.
Okay, any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, just because of the time constraints, and Brad, I know you could do it quickly, but we'd rather, I think we're going to be spending some time on this issue, and the fact that we do have to be out of here by 3 o'clock for the next committee to come in, I'm just not willing to go through, just to start it up, just to shut it down. So, and nobody else is here to testify on this bill. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and then close the public hearing on 2141 and give you the update, members. I think we'll certainly be seeing 2141 and then 2929 on Thursday. And I'll take a look at some of the other bills that we had at least planned for Thursday and might be changing the agenda a little bit to make sure we keep our focus on these issues. So, anything else, we will adjourn our meeting.